It's 7:44. I'm Chuck Anzalevich. This is West Virginia Morning. The Trump administration escalated its trade dispute with China last week, threatening to impose tariffs on an additional $200 billion worth of Chinese products. China has already retaliated against an earlier round of tariffs, and U.S. agriculture is feeling the pinch. Nicole Irwin spoke with Ohio Valley soybean and hog farmers who fear that their buyers are disappearing.
Jimmy Tosh is owner and CEO of Tosh Farms, Tosh Pork, and Bacon by Gosh in Henry County, Tennessee. Tosh is looking at about 1,200 piglets in one of his 84 contracted barns in the region.
These pigs in January were selling for the $75 to $80 mark. Because of seasonality and because of the effect of the tariffs, these pigs now are in the $16 to $18 range.
He says these little piggies will grow to be around 280 pounds before they head to the market. But with 25% of all his pork products depending on exports, if a trade war between the U.S. and China continues, he could be looking to find them a new home.
China is our fourth largest market by value. It's our third largest market by tonnage.
He says that market has gone from 1,000 metric tons 3 months ago to zero last month. Like any successful business, Tosh has plans to expand with a new unit that would produce about 225,000 pigs a year. He needs another 40 barns to do that. With the steel and aluminum tariffs in place, that would cost him an extra $15,000 plus per barn.
Whether we build another unit after that really depends on the market conditions that we're in.
The Port Council says U.S. producers face punitive tariffs on 40% of total American port exports to China and Mexico. These damages aren't expected to let up anytime soon, and the situation is just as dire for U.S. soybean farmers who have lost all contracts with China.
All right, here's our electronic grains overview.
In far west Kentucky, corn and soybean farmer Jacob Goodman checks the afternoon market prices.
And at the beginning of June, soybeans in November were trading at $10.60. And right now, the last bid at the Chicago Board of Trade was $8.90. That's a price per bushel. When you're looking at thousands of bushels, gosh, 60 or more an acre, that price adds up very quickly.
Soybeans are the top agriculture export for the U.S., and China is the top buyer. Last week, the commodity dropped to a 10-year low after China announced its retaliatory efforts. In 2017, more than half of the soybeans grown in the Ohio Valley and the U.S. went to China. Goodman says farmers are already dealing with a near 50% loss in profit over the last few years.
When you go and start picking fights with people that buy your products, that adds a whole other level to it.
Countries responding to tariffs implemented by President Trump have said they will retaliate by hitting his base of supporters hardest, farm country. Goodman says he is the only blue dot in a sea of red he knows. In other words, he didn't vote for Trump, and what's happening to his family isn't fair.
Whenever we start to threaten other countries with withholding grain or something like that, they just turn around and buy from somebody else.
Just 2 months of a trade dispute can move investors in another direction for two decades, according to the International Food Policy Institute. But will it move the president's base of support? Farm groups have kept a soft tone as Trump has pushed for new deals, including his attempts at renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement. Eddie Melton, an official with the Kentucky Farm Bureau, reflects the majority of farmers in the Ohio Valley.
There's always been challenges in agriculture, always. But through challenges, we always find opportunities. I think that this gives us an opportunity to expand markets.
Melton is hopeful. He says if China isn't willing to move in the direction the president wishes, maybe India will. Hog farmer Jimmy Tosh is not so sure.
I don't support his tariff position. I've always been a free trader, and I have a hard time understanding why the Republican Party has moved from a party of free trade to the position that we're in now.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Nicole Irwin.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Tonight at 9 o'clock, an original West Virginia Public Broadcasting hour-long documentary premieres on television that chronicles the efforts of two artisans who have created some of the world's most exquisite cameo glass. Glennis Board sat down with the two producers to learn about this glass and the film called Lasting Impressions, Making Glass in West Virginia.
Chuck Frostick and Russ Barber are producers and filmmakers here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Sure. Good morning.
Now, your documentary is largely about cameo glass. Russ, can you explain what that is?
Yes. Cameo glass, first came about in the Roman Empire. The idea was that you blow something, a bowl, a vase, whatever, and it's one color. But in the process, you add another color. Well, what Kelsey and Bob did is they figured out a way to consistently produce pieces that had as many as 11 layers of glass. What's kind of mind-boggling about it for me is that you figure out beforehand what the piece is that's in the glass, and you have the glass blown so that these layers are in there where you need them. And then when it's time to carve, you carve in such a way that you're telling a story, but you're telling it backwards because that's how you have to put the layers in.
In this documentary, you follow Kelsey Murphy and Robert Baumkamp around. Chuck, can you describe a little bit about those interviews and what it was like getting to know these artists?
Well, Kelsey is just exuberant about what they've been able to create. Bob can be a little grumpy, if you will, but he's an amazing engineer, and the two of them were just an amazing pair. They got together, they have a love for this particular glass banking, and they figured out how to make it work. Originally, when Cameo Glass was made, 95% of the pieces that were created by the different glass makers would just explode, whether it was right after they were made or once they were carving them. And they figured out through chemistry, through computer work, different things, how to make the glass last so that when they were done, 95% of the pieces were stable and they make masterpieces.
When did they master the Cameo Glass process? How long have they been doing this?
They started in the early 80s.
Have they taught their techniques to others? Are artists now carrying the tradition on?
They've been working with a number of glassmakers at both Blinko and Fenton Glass and all. They've found that some of the people that make the glass and the carvers that they have, they've etched glass, they've done things along that line, but Cameo is going through multi-layers. Original Cameo was probably 2 to 3 layers of things that were 2,000 years ago or even 100 years ago when they were making it. Kelsey and Bob figured out to make what they call super cameo, which is anything over 5 layers of glass. So they've really enhanced the whole process, and they brought in new carvers that have loved the process and have learned from Kelsey and Bob, and they've learned from the other carvers themselves how to make things better.
So can you share any anecdotes with us from your experience following these artists?
One of the things that Kelsey points out is this all came about pretty much for her by accident. She was working on flat glass at one point where they were etching, just not carving down through the layers, but they were etching glass, and she was cleaning a mirror. And her daughter came in and surprised her, and where she was etching and cleaning, it went onto the glass. And she realized this looked really beautiful, and that got them into the process and made her learn about it, read about it more, and find out about the fact that you could carve in through a number of layers of glass and do this whole process.
Also, the struggle they had to try to figure out, what tools do we use? It's not like you could go to Cameo Making Is Us. They had to figure it out. And they would take things that weren't designed for glass making at all and use them to make this process work, to make it better, to make it consistent.
And I guess I'm a little bit curious, these two folks, Kelsey and Robert, is this a love story? Were they partners in life?
They were absolutely partners in life. As Kelsey pointed out, Bob was working at another job. He had worked through the aerospace industries and different things like that. And at one point, all his tools were stolen, and he ended up coming working with her. And as she says in the documentary, it was the best day of her life when the two of them got together. They just clicked. When she needed something done, he was there 100% for her. And I think if it wasn't the two of them, they never would have developed what they did.
I see. Wow. Great. Well, Russ Barber and Chuck Frostick, filmmakers here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks.
The television documentary called Lasting Impressions, Making Glass in West Virginia, airs this evening at 9 p.m. Here's a compilation of excerpts narrated by co-producer Chuck Frostick.
Executive director of the Museum of American Glass in West Virginia for many years, Dean Six considers Cameo the king of the glass world. Glass Thetley has no peer.
It's always been the most expensive, the most skilled, the most complex glass to make. So historically in West Virginia, while we've made endless beautiful objects and decorative objects, Cameo was not a part of what we made in West Virginia until some lady named Kelsey comes around.
It's Murphy's choice of colors and the order in which she stacks them that make for such a broad and brilliant palette.
Once we got the chemistry correct, and once we understood the annealing properties and the ambient temperature problems with the glass, we could come up with any idea we wanted to, whether it was flowers that I saw on the way to work, or whether it was a drawing that I happened to make the night before. I could then go into the hot shop and say, okay, here's what we're gonna do. I want purple over white, over green, over crystal, over cobalt.
One chilly September morning at Blinko Glass Company in Milton, West Virginia, Murphy is on hand in the hot shop as staff encase kiwi-colored glass with cobalt blue glass to produce blanks in the shape of a cowboy hat.
When a blower starts a Cameo blank, he starts by dipping his blowpipe into the first color, which is very often what we call a core. It's the very thinnest layer. And they just put a little bit of air and then put their thumb over the pipe. Once that ball has cooled sufficiently, then they roll that ball with the pipe to pick up this new layer, bring it out and either strip it off or drain it off to make that cover layer a little thinner. Once the ball had all the colors on it, then it would be shaped in a block, oftentimes reheated in a glory hole, which is sort of like a can that belches raw fire at about 3,000 degrees. That reheats the ball so that it can be blown into a shape. Every day there's something new. Every image that we use, even if we've used it 50 times before on other vessels, presents new challenges.
Aluminum oxide, rather than sand, is used to carefully cut away layer after layer of glass, slowly bringing out the object's natural beauty.
It's all done inside of a cabinet that has an exhaust system so that the dust is removed. So you're looking through a glass, you've got these big old fat gloves on, then you want to remove a portion of that top layer of glass, and that has to be removed perfectly. Then you take the vessel back out of the cabinet, get rid of all of the dust that's on it, clean it, and mask the rest of the story.
Then the vessel is returned to the cabinet, where most, but not all, of the remaining surface glass is removed.
You have to still leave some surface glass on there to absorb that sort of overspray as you're detailing out. Removing parts of the resist material, the artistic elements, so that you can start to begin to shadow and shape and sculpt a figure. From that point on, you may open that door to the cabinet, take that piece of glass in and out of the cabinet 300 times before the piece is finished.
Robert P. Baumkamp.
Some of our most avid collectors are engineers that think this is impossible. 12 layers of glass, you can't do that. Well, yeah, we did. Why? Because we believed in the magic. Because we didn't know any better. We just made it happen.
Again, that was an excerpt from West Virginia Public Broadcasting's latest television documentary called Lasting Impressions, Making Glass in West Virginia. It airs this evening at 9 p.m. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Chuck Anzalevich.